morning, everyone. So far in the morning meditations with Renato before breakfast, you've been, in your shamatha practice, you've been focusing on the breath, the full body, the abdomen and nostrils. Tomorrow, you're going to start to work with the mind instead of the breath. So I thought it might be helpful to give a little introduction to the practice now, practice it a little bit so then tomorrow morning you're a little bit familiar with what you're trying to do. Now, many people find this practice, this shamatha practice, focusing on the mind, more challenging than focusing on the breath for a number of reasons. One reason, of course, is that the mind is a more subtle object. The breath is a little bit easier to focus on. It's a physical, tangible object. And the second reason many people find this quite challenging is that we have such a strong habit of always following our thoughts, emotions, and memories. Whenever one comes up, we get caught up and off we go. Because in this practice of observing the mind, what we're doing is we're trying to be like an observer or witness, simply observing thoughts, emotions, and memories as they arise and pass, without getting caught up in them, without trying to get rid of them. This is something that normally we don't do, so we don't have a habit of doing that. So when we sit down in this practice and try and observe, generally what happens is immediately something comes up, we're gone. Having said that, even though many people find this more challenging, there are enormous benefits for this practice, which I briefly mentioned, I think, on the first evening, is that now, of course, we tend to be the slaves of our mind. We're often even tormented by our own mind. We're tormented by our thoughts, emotions, and memories. This practice will help us to become the masters of our mind instead of being the slaves of our mind. Not only will we, through this practice, develop a calm, clear, focused mind, our mind will become our best friend instead of our worst enemy, as it often is now. Because every time we can observe a thought, emotion, or memory arise and pass, we're not getting caught up in it. The habit of that coming up will get less and less, and then we'll be able to be simply present with whatever comes up without being overwhelmed by it. So there are enormous benefits to this practice, and so that's why we're going to be practicing this with Renato the next few mornings of this course. Now, just a few points about the practice, and then we'll do a little practice of this just to get a taste of it. What's the object? The object in this shamatha practice is the mind plus any mental events that come up, meaning any thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images, and so forth. What is not part of the object are sense objects. So we're not focusing on any sensations in the body. We're not focusing on any sounds. We're not focusing on any visual objects. So those you just ignore. But any mental objects, any thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images, and so forth, that's what we're focusing on. So if there's nothing there, we're just focusing on the mind itself. If something comes up, we watch it as it comes up and passes, without grasping onto it, without trying to get rid of it, without trying to change anything. Now, in this practice, of course, we're not trying to make the mind still. If you've ever tried to make your mind still, it doesn't work. It just gets more agitated. So whether the mind is still or whether there's a lot of activity, doesn't matter. Both are equally good. If it's still, just watch that stillness. If there's thoughts and emotions and so forth coming up, just watch them. Whatever's there, just watch it. That's it. Now, one other thing with this practice is it's very much recommended to have the eyes open. So in general, in meditation, the general recommendation, of course, is to have the eyes slightly open. And that the general recommendation is because if we have them closed, often we become very sleepy and dull. So if we have them slightly open, a little bit of light coming in, that can help us to keep alert. But certainly in this practice, it's very much recommended to have the eyes open for a number of reasons. One, of course, the first is that reason. Having the eyes open, some light coming in, it really can help to improve the clarity of our focus and avoid becoming very dull and sleepy. Another benefit of this practice, of having the eyes open, is that with the eyes open, even though we're not really looking at anything, the visual gaze is still a little bit engaged, which means, of course, the visual gaze only happens in the present moment. So by having the eyes open, it helps to lock us more into the present moment. If we have our eyes closed, it's much easier to drift off into the past and the future. So that's another benefit. And another benefit, of course, is that in this practice, we're learning to simply observe thoughts, emotions, and memories without getting caught up in them, which, of course, is what we also want to do in our daily life. So if we meditate with our eyes open, learning to observe these mental events, then it's much easier to transition into daily life and do the same thing, because we already know how to do this with our eyes open. Because, of course, in daily life, normally we have our eyes open. So if we only meditate with our eyes closed doing this, then in daily life, we're not used to observing thoughts and emotions with our eyes open. So it's more difficult. So if we have them open in meditation, easier to transition into daily life as well. And then one more benefit with this eyes open in this practice, and that is this idea of duality. What we're beginning to talk about, and we'll talk about this about a lot tomorrow, is that the Buddhist view is that there is no subject-object duality. There is no independent me, independent world. If we meditate with our eyes closed, we generally have a very strong sense of me in here and world out there. Whereas if we have the eyes open, this sense of duality is not so strong. There's not a strong sense of inner and outer. So by having them open, it starts to help us to break down the false sense of duality. So it's really helpful to transition with the eyes open in this practice into the Vipassana practice. Because in the Vipassana practice, we're coming to realize there's no duality. So if we're already sort of a little bit familiar with that experientially in this with the eyes open, very helpful. So these are the reasons to have the eyes open in this practice. Now, if you're not used to meditating with your eyes open, you're probably going to find this a little bit sort of uncomfortable and not easy. But what I'd recommend is that persist with it, and you probably will find that it'll get a lot easier. This was my experience. When I first started meditating many years ago, I had a very agitated mind. And so if I had my eyes slightly open, I just got agitated. So I had to have them closed, which helped the agitation. But then, of course, over time, I realized I was just sort of going into dullness. And then when I was introduced to this practice some years ago, when I first meditated with my eyes open, I found it very uncomfortable or very not easy. But I very quickly got used to it. And now I generally only meditate with my eyes open, and I find it much better. So that's another recommendation. Just sit, you'll find that the more you do it, the easier it gets. So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a very short meditation, the shamatha practice of observing the mind, just so you get a little bit of a taste of it, so that tomorrow when Renato starts doing that with you, you already know a little bit what to do. Quick question? Right. Yes, good point. So with the eyes open, we're not straining the eyes. So we're not sort of holding them open and not blinking. If blink as often as you need, and don't strain the eyes in any way. We're not trying to deliberately unfocus. You know, sometimes people try to deliberately unfocus their gaze, and of course that's straining their eyes. So we don't want to strain the eyes in any way. Just naturally resting your gaze in front of you, blinking as often as you need. You can have the eyes naturally open, or you can have them just slightly open. Whichever works better for you, doesn't matter. Okay? So quick question.
Just when you when I meditate with the sense of breathing, then I'm grasping the feeling. I'm holding, like I'm focusing on the feeling.
Right.
But when I need to focus on my mind, it changes all the time. Not like the feeling of the breath.
Well, the feeling of the breath changes every time as well.
Okay, but
no, doesn't it? I think it does. Every breath is different.
But it's more okay.
Yeah. So maybe at the beginning phase we don't notice that. But the more you get into the breath practice, the more you'll notice that every single breath is different.
My question is, what should I grasp on?
Well, we're not grasping on anything. We're not even grasping. Yeah. But again, we're just simply observing the mind and whatever comes up in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, just watching it come up and pass. And in the meditation now, I'll give a little bit of a helping thing to help us to get into the practice. But again, this is something that we can only learn through experience. So let's start. Okay, now that you brought it up. One thing you can do, as with the breath practice, you know, if we get swept away in the breath practice, one thing that can help is counting the breath or labeling or noting the breath, which we talked a little bit about. Similarly, in this practice, if you find that you're constantly getting swept away, try labeling. So if something comes up, give it a name. Just go thought, memory, irritation, image. Give it a name, and that may help. So you could introduce that if you want. Okay, let's do the practice. As always, we begin by preparing the body. So keeping the back nice and straight. And allow the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. and then preparing the mind, setting it into a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Through focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now allow your eyes to be at least partially open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, keeping your eyes soft and relaxed, not straining the eyes in any way, and blink as often as you need. And now bring your attention to your own mind. And simply observe your own mind and whatever is arising in the mind. Thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. Simply observing these mental events as they arise and pass, without following them, without trying to get rid of them. Simply be like an impartial observer or witness, observing these mental events. If you're new to this practice and you're not sure where to focus, then every now and again, deliberately generate a thought. Any thought will do. And watch that thought as it arises in your mind. And watch it as it disappears back into the mind. And then keep your attention right where it was. And see what comes up next in that space. Now, if you've got caught up in a thought and got carried away, remember the first thing to do is simply relax and then release grasping onto that thought and very gently return to observing the mind. And if there's nothing arising in the mind, simply observe that stillness. And if you're becoming frustrated at not being able to do the practice well, then simply observe that frustration. Whatever is arising in the mind, observe it. So that was a little taster of the shamatha practice of observing the mind. So again, probably many of you found that more a little bit more challenging than observing the breath. But again, I think if we persist with this practice, there are enormous benefits from this practice. Particularly if we're the sort of person that is often tormented by our own mind. Through doing this practice, we can really become the masters of our own mind. We can really make our mind our best friend instead of our worst enemy. So for the next, I think, 3 mornings at least, you'll be practicing this with Renato. Okay. Well, we're not staring in this practice.
I open my eyes and then I have fix my eyes in one object, no?
No. No, it's we're not looking at anything with our eyes. It's a little bit like sometimes during the day we daydream, you know, we're daydreaming. And often we have our eyes open. We're not really looking at anything when we're daydreaming, are we? Because we're focused on the daydream, like that. We're focused on observing the mind with the eyes open. We're not really looking at anything. So it's the same thing as when we're daydreaming. Often when we're daydreaming, we're not really even aware of what's really in front of us because we're so focused on our daydream. Exactly like that. Now, what will happen is, of course, if there's a lot of movement in front of us, our eyes will be drawn by that. So here, of course, probably not so ideal conditions for this practice because maybe people in front of you are moving and maybe there's lights flickering in front or something. At home, we can control that. So for this practice as a beginner, often at home, it's good to have a blank wall, nothing to catch the attention. And me personally, I like it quite dark. So this is something we can adjust at home. So here, of course, not ideal conditions, but if you find that with your eyes open, your eyes are constantly moving around, then fix on one point and use that as an anchor, but not really focusing on it. So we're not really looking at anything. Yeah. Okay. But anyway, Renato will be, be giving some more tips about this practice in the coming days as well. And also I'll be talking a little bit more about this in a couple of days' time. Let's start with a review now, short review, before we move on to the next topic. So we're using the Four Noble Truths, of course, as the framework for our discussions. That was the very first teaching the Buddha gave. It's the foundation of all Buddhist traditions. And so what we saw there in the first two noble truths, the first two noble truths is the Buddha's diagnosis for us. That his diagnosis was that we are stuck in this state of dukkha, this unsatisfactory state. And at the deepest level, the word dukkha means there's always a potential for suffering to arise in our life because we have mental afflictions. And so that really points to the second noble truth. Why are we stuck in this state of dukkha is because of our mental afflictions. And the root mental affliction is this ignorance, this fundamental ignorance, this misunderstanding of the nature of reality. It's a grasping onto an independent me and an independent objective world. And through grasping onto that, we end up with attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and a whole lot of other things, mental afflictions and then suffering. And we saw yesterday that we are stuck in this state, life after life after life. And that cycling in this state, life after life, is called samsara. And so we saw there that we can cycle amongst many different types of existences. And where we end up in the next existence, the next life, is primarily determined by how we lead our life. If we lead a good life, try not to harm and do harmful behavior, we end up in a good place. If we do a lot of non-virtuous, harmful behavior, we end up in not such a good place. But we can continuously cycle between these different types of existences, these six types of existences we saw yesterday. And we were using this chart, this diagram, the wheel of life, to describe that. And there was one more part to that which we didn't finish yesterday, which I'd like to just briefly go through now. And that in this diagram, we didn't go through these 12 diagrams around the outside, which are called the 12 links. So I'd like to just briefly go through those now before we move on to the next topic. So these 12 links here are a description of how we are stuck in this cycle of existence called samsara because of our ignorance and mental afflictions. So let's have a look at these 12 links and see if we can make some sense of them. So if we go right up the top here with the first diagram, about 1 o'clock, we see a person with a stick. That's a blind person with a stick to help them find the way. So that, of course, is symbolizing ignorance, meaning we are blinded by ignorance. We're not seeing reality clearly. And because of that, that leads to mental afflictions, and that's driving our behavior. And so the second link, the second diagram here, we see a person with a potter's wheel, a spinning wheel with clay, and they're forming a pot. And so this is talking about the actions that we do result because of our mental afflictions. And these 12 links are describing the process of how we go from life to life. So this second link here is just describing the actions that we do that create or lead to a new life. So that's why we have the potter's wheel and the clay, because the actions we do now are literally forming what our future is going to look like. So that's why the analogy of the clay forming the pot. So if we do good actions, we're forming a good future. If we're doing harmful actions now, we're forming not such a good future. Every action we do, of course, is imprinted on the consciousness, on the mind. And so that is the third diagram here. So the third diagram here is consciousness, and that's symbolized here by a monkey in front of a house with 5 windows and a door. And the monkey's jumping between the windows and the door. And what that is symbolizing is now our mind is jumping from the different sense fields to the mental field. You know, we're attracted by some sound, some visual object, some thought. We're jumping all around everywhere. So often the expression you hear in this point is crazy monkey mind. Our mind is like a crazy monkey jumping all over the place. Then, of course, that imprint that is planted on the consciousness ripens. And here in these 12 links, we're only talking about those actions which result in another existence. So when that imprint ripens, it ripens as the next life. And that the beginning of the next life is what is described in link 4. Link 4 here is called name and form. And symbolized here, we see a boat with some people in the boat. So remember briefly we said yesterday, the new life begins when the consciousness conjoins with the fertilized egg in the womb. So that's name and form, when they come together. The boat is symbolizing the fertilized egg, the beginnings of the body, and the mind, the consciousness, is symbolized by the people in the boat. So the symbolism here, of course, is the vessel for our mind is the body. The body is the support of our mind. So that's why the symbolism of the people in the boat. So when that consciousness conjoins with the fertilized egg in the womb, then, of course, the embryo and fetus develop. And during that development, at some point, the sense faculties become developed and operational. That is link number 5, called the 6 sense spheres. So that is symbolized here. In link 5, we see a house with 5 windows and a door. So again, the 5 windows are the 5 sense faculties, and the door is the mental faculty. So that's symbolizing the point at where our faculties become operational. When our sense faculties and mental faculty become operational, of course, they contact the object. And so that is link 6, is contact. And so here, contact is very graphically symbolized by a couple making love. There's a lot of contact happening there. So, of course, once we contact an object, we have a feeling arising, meaning when we contact an object, we experience that as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So that is link number 7, feeling. And so feeling here also very graphically symbolized by a person with an arrow stuck in their eye. So there's a lot of feeling going on there. And as we saw yesterday and the day before, when we have pleasant and unpleasant feelings arising, that often leads to attachment and aversion. And here, link number 8 is symbolizing the beginnings of attachment, or here it's called craving. And that is symbolized here with a person with some alcohol, craving alcohol. And then, of course, when we crave something, then we try to get it. And that is symbolizing the next link of 9, of grasping. So when we crave something, we try to actually get it, we grasp at it. And so that is symbolized in the 9th link of grasping by a monkey in a tree grasping fruit. This craving and grasping here in the 12 links is a very specific craving and grasping. And that is, at the end of our life, when we're going through the death process and it seems like we are going out of existence, we crave and grasp to life itself. And that is the symbolizing, that is link 8 and 9. We are craving life and we are grasping to life through the death process. And that craving and grasping to life causes a karmic imprint in our mind to become activated, which will determine the next life. And that activated imprint is link 10, called becoming. And that is symbolized here by a pregnant woman, a woman about to give birth. So that activated imprint is about to give birth to a new life. And so then, of course, when a new life begins of its birth, which is link 11. And so link 11 here, birth, is symbolized by a woman actually giving birth. And then, of course, what comes after birth is aging and death. And that is link 12, which is symbolized here by an old person carrying a sack on their back. And in the sack is a corpse, a dead body. So this is symbolizing aging and death. So what we can see from these 12 links is that birth, aging, and death, if we keep going back to the beginning, we see is coming from ignorance. So from this, we can see that we are trapped in this cycle of birth, aging, and death due to our ignorance. But then we can understand, well, how can we overcome aging and death? We need to overcome birth. And so we keep going back to the beginning. We can understand if we overcome ignorance, we'll overcome the second link, third link, and then birth, aging, and death. So how to overcome the cycle of birth, aging, and death is to eliminate ignorance. So these 12 links help us to understand how we are stuck in this cycle, but also how to break free of the cycle. So, of course, that was a super brief 10-minute explanation. This is a very detailed topic, these 12 links. If you ever get a chance to get a more detailed presentation, I thoroughly recommend it. I find them very helpful. If you want to read about it, there's a book from the Dalai Lama called The Meaning of Life, which describes these 12 links in a lot more detail, of course. But any questions about the 12 links before we move on to this morning's topic?
You said when we die, at the moment we die, we are holding resting of our life.
Before we die, yes. When we're going through the death process, so it's before we actually die.
That makes our reading consciousness, that makes our consciousness join next to life.
No, the grasping causes an imprint to be activated.
If we don't have any
grasping, you don't have rebirth. But to have no grasping, we're liberated because we've got rid of the mental afflictions. So yes, we've cut the whole process then. We've liberated. We're already out of samsara. That's the goal.
What about the people who suicide? They don't have grasping and rebirth.
Remember, here, this craving and grasping is not intellectual. It's instinctive at a more subtle level. It's not something we have control over. We can't go, when we're dying, we can't go, okay, I'm not going to grasp another life and thereby I'll be liberated. It's not going to happen. This is instinctive grasping. Now, of course, we may understand grasping is not good, but simply going, I'm not going to grasp on anything, is not going to result in no grasping. We need to realize the nature of reality for that to happen. So if we want to not grasp at the time of death, we need to eliminate attachment. Therefore, we have to eliminate ignorance. If we eliminate ignorance, yes, absolutely. We're liberated. There's no grasping. We're not reborn in samsara again. Yes. Yeah, so name and form, name is consciousness, form is body. So it's the point at where the consciousness joins with the fertilized egg in the womb, when they come together and a new life begins. Okay, let's move on to this morning's topic then. So now we've talked about the first two noble truths. So that's the Buddha's diagnosis, that we're stuck in this cycle through our ignorance and mental afflictions. Third noble truth, of course, is the Buddha's prognosis, the truth of cessation, that we can be liberated from this cycle, that we can achieve a healthy state. And then the fourth noble truth, truth of the path, of course, is the cure, the medicine. So let's now have a look at the third and fourth noble truth. And so remember, we've said that if we can overcome ignorance and mental afflictions and achieve liberation and go beyond samsara, this cycle of existence, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. But remember, Prince Siddhartha achieved enlightenment and became a Buddha. So what's the difference between nirvana and enlightenment? So let's look at that now, and in the context of looking at the third and fourth noble truth. And so to do this, we're going to look at your extra handout again, the other side, the three vehicles. Thank you. So a vehicle is something that can, of course, help us to get to a certain destination. So we talked about now, if we eliminate ignorance and mental afflictions and we go beyond samsara, we can achieve the goal of nirvana. Someone who has achieved that goal and gone beyond samsara is called, in Sanskrit, an arhat. The word arhat often is translated into English as something like foe destroyer, or someone who has destroyed the enemy. So, of course, the enemy that the arhat has destroyed is the mental afflictions, these afflictive obscurations. So an arhat has destroyed or eliminated ignorance and all mental afflictions. The vehicle that can get us to the goal of nirvana now is commonly known as Theravada. And remember, we said that this vehicle or system of teachings is coming through the Pali language from India. And so the modern-day Buddhist traditions that belong to the Theravada, of course, is Sri Lankan Buddhism, Burmese, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, Southeast Asia. And so in those traditions, the goal of the spiritual path is nirvana, liberation from samsara, becoming an arhat. And on the first morning of this course, we said that the entry point into that path to nirvana, the aspiration that we need to develop, is commonly translated into English as renunciation. But what we said was, of course, that this actual translation into renunciation is not a very good translation, but it was used many years ago and it sort of stuck. The actual original word, nisarana in Sanskrit, literally means the wish to move out of samsara to nirvana. So this aspiration is literally the wish for liberation from samsara. So that's what renunciation actually is referring to. This simple wish for liberation from samsara, understanding that the cause or the reason we're stuck in this samsara is our mental afflictions, and that we can eliminate them. If we understand that this mental afflictions and ignorance is the source or the root of this cycle of samsara, and that we can eliminate them, then we can develop this aspiration to be free of samsara, understanding that we can eliminate the mental afflictions. Now, someone who's developed this aspiration based on the translation of renunciation, often you'll hear, we'll talk about a renunciate, someone who's developed renunciation. But again, this can be misleading, this term, because often then people feel, because remember, this is the entry point into the Buddhist spiritual path. Then people go, I don't want to become a renunciate because I don't want to go and live in a cave for the rest of my life. This is not the meaning. Where you live is not the issue. We're talking about your motivation. If you have the aspiration to be free of samsara, understanding we can eliminate the mental afflictions, then we have entered the Buddhist spiritual path. Now, how do we achieve this goal? What is the fourth noble truth? Truth of the path. What is the medicine? What practices do we need to engage in to achieve the goal of nirvana? Generally here, the normal presentation is what's called the Noble Eightfold Path. And we see here in our chart a list of 8 practices that we are to engage in if we want to achieve the goal of nirvana. And if we look at these 8 practices, such as right speech, action, livelihood, and so forth, what we can see is that all of these 8 practices we can condense into 3 main core areas of practice called the 3 higher trainings. Here, of course, we see the 3 core areas of practice. The first one is ethics, or in Sanskrit, shila. So here, of course, ethics, the core of ethics is avoiding harmful, non-virtuous behavior. On that basis, the second core area of practice is concentration. And the word concentration in general in Sanskrit is samadhi. And what we saw was that this concentration practice, particularly in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, when we talk about concentration practice, we simply call it shamatha practice, because that's the level of samadhi we're trying to develop. Here in the Theravada traditions, when they talk about samadhi practice, normally you won't hear the word shamatha, but you'll hear another word, jhana, because jhana is also a particular level of concentration that we can develop. So often in Theravada traditions, when they talk about concentration practice, they talk about developing the jhanas. Whereas in the Mahayana traditions, they often say shamatha. But they're both talking about developing concentration. On the basis of developing concentration, then we enter into the wisdom practice. And wisdom in Sanskrit is prajna, in Pali, panya. Another word for the wisdom practice in Sanskrit, of course, is vipassana, in Pali, vipassana. So remember, vipassana or vipassana often is translated as insight or special insight. So, of course, here, this wisdom practice is we're talking about gaining insight into the nature of reality. So those of you who, of course, have done Goenka Vipassana retreat know about these 3 practices a lot, because the Goenka Vipassana retreat, of course, is based on the Burmese tradition, or one of the Burmese traditions, so it's Theravada. So, of course, Goenkaji, when he gives his talks, is talking a lot about the 3 core areas of practice: Shila, Samadhi, Panya. Shila, Samadhi, Panya. Ethics, concentration, wisdom. These are the 3 core areas of practice. Now, when we talk about the wisdom practice or the vipassana practice, or in Sanskrit, vipassana, what do we mean? What sort of insight are we to develop? Here in the Theravada traditions, when we talk about vipassana practice, we're talking about gaining 3 particular insights called the 3 marks of existence. And again, those who have done a Goenka retreat know the first one very well, because it's probably the word that Goenka uses the most in the entire retreat: anicca, 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 which is the Pali word for impermanence. In Sanskrit, anitya. So we are to come to gain the insight into impermanence, the fact that things are changing moment by moment. Now, of course, we all, I think, intellectually accept that already. I think we all intellectually accept that things are changing moment by moment. because science has proven it. We learnt it at school. I think none of us have any issues about accepting impermanence intellectually. But is our intellectual understanding of impermanence, is that helping us in our life at all? Not really. Because again, our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits are telling us this is quite stable. And that's how we relate to things, as quite stable. But of course, that way of relating to things is completely out of sync with reality. The reality is nothing is stable. Everything is changing moment by moment. But by relating to things as stable, we are not seeing things as they are. We are out of sync with reality. And that leads to mental afflictions and suffering. So if we want impermanence to help us in our life, we need to bring that intellectual understanding into experience. We need to experientially see that things are changing moment by moment. And that in meditation. And that will start to transform our mind. So if we can start to realize impermanence or see it directly in meditation, that will start to have a very big impact on our mind, start to transform our mind. So much so that outside of meditation, in daily life, we're going to more and more instinctively see things as changing moment by moment, which means when we interact with these things, we'll be much more in harmony with reality. And what you're going to find is that if we can have that experience of impermanence pervading our life, you're going to find your level of attachment and aversion and other mental afflictions will dramatically reduce, dramatically. You'll be much more in harmony with life. You'll be more in the flow of life. Now, of course, life is flowing. It's a fact. But often what we do now, of course, is that when life is flowing and we see something nice in that flow, we grab it. We try to hold on to it. And of course, we can't hold on to it because it's flowing. And so it takes a lot of stress and agitation to try and hold on to it. And then when we lose it, of course, we get frustrated and upset. So what we're doing is we are fighting against impermanence now. And therefore, we have mental afflictions and we suffer. If we can bring this into experience, instead of fighting against impermanence and seeing impermanence as bad news, we'll be in the flow of impermanence. Impermanence will be good news, meaning we'll be able to use that flow to our advantage to navigate in a good direction in our life. So if we can really do this Vipassana practice, come to have a taste and experience of impermanence, already our lives will dramatically improve. The second insight is the insight into dukkha, the first noble truth. Because if we can, you know, maybe again intellectually we may appreciate that we're sort of in this state. But still, we're going to be chasing after pleasures because that's instinctively we feel the happiness is coming from there. So again, if we can internalize this, if we can meditate and come to experience this dukkha, what will happen is we are going to easily develop this aspiration for nirvana because we're going to experientially see there's no genuine happiness to be found out there. And then we're going to develop a wish to be for liberation, understanding that the source of suffering is in here. And so once we've developed that insight and developed that aspiration, then of course we need to strive for nirvana. And to do that, we need the third insight. The insight into no self, or in Sanskrit, anatma. So here, in the Theravada tradition, It's understood that this grasping to self is the fundamental ignorance that we're suffering from. That we overinflate a sense of me and we believe that we are more solid and substantial than we really are. And we're going to talk about this idea of self in more detail tomorrow, but very brief now, just to get a little bit of an idea of what we mean by self, is now we instinctively have this sense that somewhere here is a me that is more than just the body and the mind. We instinctively feel there's a third thing here. There's a body and a mind, and there's a me. And this me is something a little bit different than just the body and the mind. And we have this in our language. We say, I have a body. I have a mind. As if there's a third thing, a me that has a body and has a mind. And also, sometimes we look at our body, we don't really like what we see, and sometimes we even have the thought, I'd like to swap this body for a younger, more beautiful, more healthy body. Sometimes we have this thought. And then sometimes we look at our mind and it's a mess. And sometimes we even have the thought, I want to swap this mind for a more intelligent, more kind, less neurotic mind. But the question is, where is the me who could do this swap? Because if we take away the body and the mind, is there anything left over? Again, intellectually, we may understand that. We may intellectually understand that actually there's nothing more than the body and the mind here. But again, is that intellectual understanding helping us? No. Because instinctively, that's not how we're seeing ourselves. Instinctively, when we're engaging in activities, we're grasping onto the idea that, in fact, there is this self here. There's a me that is more than just the body and the mind. And that's the me we relate to in our behaviour. And again, that's a false sense of me. So we're out of sync with reality. That's why we develop mental afflictions and suffering. Now, of course, no Buddhist tradition says there's no me. This is nihilism. The question is not, do I exist or not? The question is, how do I exist? And here in the Theravada, the assertion is that we do not exist in this way. There is no autonomous, self-sufficient me to be found here. And if we grasp onto that, we'll develop mental afflictions and suffering. If we can realize we do not exist in this way, we'll be able to eliminate all of our mental afflictions and suffering, and we can, from that vipassana insight, we can achieve nirvana. So this is vipassana or wisdom practice in the Theravada traditions. So those of you who've done a Goenka retreat, of course, in the Goenka retreat, based on Theravada, of course, when they do vipassana practice in that retreat, you're only really doing the first one. You're scanning the body, looking at sensations, not getting caught up in them, good, but on top of that, understanding anicca, 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 that everything in the body is changing moment by moment. So the Goenka retreat is really only focusing on the first of the three insights, and only with respect to the body. Actually, technically speaking, to call it a 10-day vipassana retreat is a bit misleading. Because for the first 4 days in that retreat, you only do anapanasati, or mindfulness of breathing. So for the first 4 days, you're doing no vipassana. You're only doing concentration practice. Because, like every Buddhist tradition, it's understood if we don't have a more calm, clear, focused mind, and then we try to do vipassana practice, it's not going to work because we're just going to get distracted and dull. So therefore, in that retreat, we spend 4 days, 10 hours a day, focusing on the breath to hopefully develop a little bit of concentration so that for the next 5 days, we can actually do Vipassana and maybe come to have some taste or experience of impermanence. Okay, so this is the Theravada vehicle. Any questions? Correct. Vipassana is the wisdom practice.
And the 3 masters
in the Theravada tradition, when we say Vipassana practice, it means to gain insight. Insight into what? These 3 things. So Vipassana practice in Theravada means coming to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self. All 3 are Vipassana. They are the basis of this. So if we look at the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood is ethics. That's the foundation. Without ethics, we won't be able to develop concentration. Without concentration, there's no way Vipassana practice is going to work. So this is the basis of this, which is the basis of this. So we need all 3 to be effective.
And can I say that I am a body, but I am the mind?
You could say, I am the mind, but then you don't have a mind.
But I have the mind, so I can exercise it. I agree that it's not a material of this world.
Okay, if you say you are the mind, so I and mind are equivalent, correct? That's what you're saying. How tall are you? Is it? Yeah. I mean, and you have a certain... Because if you say you are the mind, it means they're the same. It means that every quality that you have, the mind must have, if they're the same. That's an implication of saying, I am the mind.
But for my height and other physical attributes, I can relate to that with my body. So my height is 5'8", and that's a lot.
But don't you also say I have a mind? You don't have a mind?
I am a mind.
You don't have a mind? If you have a mind, you can't be the mind. It's illogical to say you have something and you are it. It's illogical. But we're going to look at this in detail tomorrow, so maybe we'll leave this till tomorrow. Because we're going to talk a lot about this tomorrow.
So you say before Buddha, yogic tradition.
The what, sorry?
Before Buddha.
Before Buddha.
Yogic tradition.
Yogic tradition.
Yogi, yoga. Hindu, yoga. Yogi.
we'll just say spiritual traditions.
In India.
Spiritual traditions in India, yeah. At the time of the Buddha, yes.
You said they only get to concentration, samadhi.
This one.
Yeah, they didn't realize wisdom.
Correct.
So that means before Buddha, no one realized about the 3 nature of reality, impermanence, dukkha, and self. There was no realization about those 3.
There was no realization of this.
So this was the great realization,
yes,
of Buddha.
This, yes.
So Buddhism started from that realization about no self.
Yes.
There is a big difference between Hinduism and Buddha.
That's what's said, yes. Because often in these traditions, because this is a translation of Atma, often in these traditions they say there is Atma. And we're going to look at tomorrow what. And of course, Atman is just a word, and it can refer to many things. But tomorrow we're going to look at 2 specific definitions of the word Atman that were around at the time of the Buddha, that the Buddha refuted. So we'll look at that tomorrow morning.
Can you just briefly explain, in the Theravada tradition, do they believe in enlightenment and just it is not their goal? And why is their goal Nirvana?
Sure. I think generally, of course, in the Theravada, they also accept that Prince Siddhartha became enlightened.
Because they wouldn't say he was an arhat.
No. But I think generally in the Theravada, there's not really much of a distinction between nirvana and enlightenment, apart from the Buddha had some special abilities. And my understanding, at least, is that it's generally understood that Prince Siddhartha, in the Theravada now, was someone special, that he managed to achieve enlightenment, but we don't have that capacity. So the best that we can do is achieve nirvana. Whereas in the Mahayana, which we're going to look at next, the general assertion is that we all have the potential and will eventually achieve enlightenment. One question, then break time. So the question is, did the Buddha achieve enlightenment in his in that life? Again, it depends. There are a number of interpretations. Generally, again, I think in Theravada, it's accepted that Prince Siddhartha was sort of a normal sort of person and did do all the work and achieved enlightenment in that life. Generally in the Mahayana, but particularly certainly in Tibetan Buddhism, it's actually generally accepted that he was already enlightened and he was just showing, displaying how to do it. And what that means, we have to talk about a little bit. We haven't come to that yet. But that's often, certainly in Tibetan Buddhism, it's generally accepted that Prince Siddhartha was actually already enlightened and he was manifesting in that way to show people how to achieve enlightenment. So there are a number of different perspectives within Buddhism about what Prince Siddhartha did in his life. Okay, time for a morning break. So 15-minute break, come back at 10:30, and we'll look at the Mahayana vehicle next.